Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading from the August 4th, 2017 issue of the Week magazine. The cover this week is a drawing of Donald Trump, and he's in his usual blue suit and red tie, got a smile on his face, and he's holding out in front of him in the foreground. It's one of those old Monopoly cards. It's yellow community chess and shows a little guy coming out of a bird cage, and it says, "Get out of jail free. This card may be kept until needed or sold." And the title on the drawing is "Pardon Me." Trump weighs his options for halting the Russia investigation, including pardoning himself. And with that, we'll go to the main stories and how they're covered. Trump aims Russia rage at Sessions. What happened? President Trump escalated his unprecedented public campaign against his attorney general this week, attacking Jeff Sessions as beleaguered and very weak, and repeatedly suggesting he might fire the senior cabinet member over his decision to recuse himself from the Russia investigation. Sessions' recusal was unfair to the president, and that's a mild word, Trump initially told the New York Times. In the following days, the president launched several attacks on Sessions, one of Trump's earliest and most outspoken supporters, railing against him on Twitter for failing to investigate Hillary Clinton for crimes and Russia relations, and saying the attorney general should have done more to crack down on intelligence leaks. Asked during a news conference if he planned to fire Sessions, Trump replied, "Time will tell." Democrats accused Trump of targeting Sessions as part of a broader strategy to undermine Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into potential collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia, and perhaps to make it possible to fire Mueller. The president is being very transparent, said Representative Adam Schiff, Democratic from California. He wants to appoint a more malleable attorney general who can tell Bob Mueller, "You will look at this, but you won't look at these other areas." Conservative groups rallied to the attorney general's defense, and Sessions said he would stay on as long as that is appropriate. What the columnist said, "Donald Trump is a nightmare boss," said Michael Brendan Doherty in NationalReview.com. "The president demands absolute loyalty from his political hirelings, yet the moment he feels cornered, he gleefully humiliates those same supporters to redirect all the blame below." "Ditching Sessions won't help Trump in the longer run," said David Graham in TheAtlantic.com. "If the president succeeds in interfering with Mueller's Russia investigation, it will only increase suspicions that Trump has something to hide. Besides, after the way he's treated Sessions, who could Trump ever persuade to take the attorney general's place?" The president is right to be furious about the Russia witch hunt, said Scott Greer in DailyCaller.com, but firing Sessions would be terrible for Trumpism. "The attorney general has done more than any other cabinet member to advance Trump's anti-establishment, anti-immigration agenda, using the Justice Department to target sanctuary cities and back tough law enforcement measures. Trump said he was creating a movement to make America great again, but without loyal soldiers like Sessions, that movement will die." Trump's humiliation of Sessions is a multi-tiered tower of political idiocy, says Ross Douthat in the New York Times. The president is telling other frustrated cabinet members to get out while the getting's good, and his behavior damages his standing with Republican senators and voters who admire Sessions. Trump is incapable of exercising sane judgment, conscience, or self-control. You can be as loyal as Sessions and still suffer the consequences of that plain and inescapable truth. The president should not be the president, and the sooner he is not, the better. And we'll go into a second short main story. Senate Republicans grapple with Obamacare repeal. What happened? Divided Senate Republicans frantically tried to revive attempts to overhaul the nation's health care system this week after two measures to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act went down in defeat. As the week went to press, lawmakers were holding a series of votes on various alternatives and amendments in an effort to pass Obamacare replacement bill by week's end. Republican leaders and President Trump scored a narrow 51-50 victory on Tuesday to start debate on the issue, with Vice President Mike Pence providing the tie-breaking vote. Senator John McCain, who announced last week he is battling brain cancer, returned to the chamber to a standing ovation and voted for debate to proceed, then admonished his colleagues for their paralyzing hyperpartisanship. "We're getting nothing done, my friends." Hours later, McCain voted for the Republicans' most comprehensive plan to replace the ACA, but the measure was decisively defeated, 43-57. The next day, senators rejected a bill that would have repealed the health care law and given Congress 2 years to replace it, this time by a 45-55 margin. The Senate was also set to consider a, quote, skinny repeal that would eliminate the individual mandate but preserve the Medicaid expansion, a move that the Congressional Budget Office has previously estimated would leave 15 million more Americans without health insurance by 2026. What the columnist said, "Never have we seen such a chaotic, rash legislative process on such a serious matter," said Jennifer Rubin in the Washington Post. "Desperate to pass something, anything they can call Obamacare repeal, GOP senators appear willing to throw millions off Medicaid rolls and spike health care costs for many of President Trump's voters. With the skinny repeal, they'll encourage younger, healthier people to leave the insurance market, accelerating the Obamacare death spiral. These lawmakers look like teenagers out for a joyride, ones who promised they'd wreck the family car and will look foolish if they renege. Failure to repeal is not an option," said Ford O'Connell in the Washington Examiner. Promising to eliminate Obamacare propelled Republicans to power across the country. Voters want the problem solved. The GOP might want to take a page from Hillary Clinton, of all people. When she lost her 1990s health care reform bid, she settled for small-bore ideas, like the Children's Health Insurance Program, that moved the ball incrementally. Republicans should do the same. Figure out how to get most of what they want now and the rest later. Whatever Republicans come up with, Trump owns it, said Sarah Cliff in Vox.com. During the campaign, he repeatedly promised a health care plan that covers everyone with lower premiums and better care. And his voters believed him. Yet every repeal bill so far breaks that promise, even as Trump pressures lawmakers to move forward and deliver him a political win. Trump's base has continued to believe the president is working in their best interest. If the Senate health bill becomes law, those beliefs will be shattered. Our controversy of the week, Trump. What if he fires Mueller? 6 months into his presidency, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com, Donald Trump is mobilizing for war against the rule of law. In an interview last week with the New York Times, President Trump strongly hinted that he may fire Robert Mueller, the special counsel investigating contacts between Russia's government and Trump's 2016 presidential campaign. Trump said he would consider it a violation if Mueller looked into his financial dealings and tax returns to see if he has business ties to Russia, an indication Trump is probably hiding something deeply incriminating. Trump surrogates, meanwhile, are already laying the groundwork for Mueller's dismissal, accusing the lifelong Republican of partisan bias and conflicts of interest. Trump can't fire Mueller directly, said Doyle McManus in the Los Angeles Times. He would have to give the order to Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. If Rosenstein refused, it might spark an ugly repeat of President Nixon's Saturday night massacre during Watergate, with Trump firing Justice Department officials until one agreed to do his bidding. Another option is for Trump to force out Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who recused himself from the Russia probe, and replace him with a loyalist willing to fire Mueller. Either way, it seems we're headed for a constitutional crisis and a presidency-destroying disaster. Actually, Trump can probably fire Mueller and get away with it, said Scott Lemieux in TheWeek.com. The only remedy for such an abuse of power would be impeachment, or for Congress to reappoint Mueller as an unfireable independent counsel. And the Republicans controlling Congress have made it clear that Trump can be as corrupt as he wants, so long as he supports their agenda. From a purely tactical standpoint, firing Mueller sooner rather than later might be a smart move for Trump, said Peter Beinart in TheAtlantic.com. Better to provoke a showdown now rather than wait for Mueller to uncover something damning that damages Trump's support among Republicans. Rather than fire Mueller, said James Freeman in WSJ.com, Trump should insist that his investigation be reined in. Mueller is reportedly pouring through Trump's real estate deals with Russians from years ago, as well as the finances of former campaign manager Paul Manafort. That suggests that he's found no evidence of collusion with Russia and is now engaged in a classic fishing expedition. To ensure fairness, Rosenstein should issue a new set of orders limiting the scope of Mueller's inquiry to real violations of federal law during the 2016 campaign. No American, not even Donald Trump, deserves to be the subject of an investigation without limits. But every American deserves to know the truth about Trump and Russia, said Zach Bocamp in Vox.com. The order creating the special counsel's investigation directed Mueller to look into any links and or coordination between the Russian government and individuals associated with the campaign, as well as any cover-ups or obstruction of justice. To now rule that Trump has associates financial dealings with Russia should be off-limits and wouldn't pass the smell test. Even the Republicans who have, up to now, bowed down to Trump have limits, said David Linhart in the New York Times. They just overwhelmingly passed new Russia sanctions over his objections, and several have publicly defended Mueller and Sessions from Trump's unhinged attacks. With Trump's approval rating mired below 40%, Republicans' support for Trump has started to crack. If Trump tests GOP leaders' loyalty by triggering a Nixonian crisis, he may be disappointed. And it's time for our good week, bad week short pieces. It was a good week for armchair analysis after the American Psychoanalytic Association informed its members that they are free to publicly offer their opinions on the mental health of President Trump, since Trump behavior is so different from anything we've ever seen. It was a good week for the brave new world after Wisconsin software company Three Square Market offered employees the option of being implanted with microchips, enabling them to open doors, log into computers, and make purchases at vending machines with just a wave of the hand. This is the future, CEO Todd Westby said. And it was a good week for loopy ideas after billionaire tech entrepreneur Elon Musk said he had received verbal government approval to begin construction of a subterranean hyperloop that would allow passengers to travel from New York to Washington, D.C. in 29 minutes. But it was a bad week for modern gladiators after researchers found evidence of the degenerative brain disease, CTE, in 110 of the 111 ex-NFL players' brains posthumously donated to science by relatives. This is a problem in football we need to address, said researcher Ann McKee. It was a bad week for believers after officials in China banned Justin Bieber from performing in the country in an effort to purify the nation and protect it from badly behaved entertainers. And finally, it was a bad week for oversharing after actress Hilary Duff's Los Angeles home was burglarized of jewelry and other items while she was on vacation in Canada. Authorities suspect that Duff may be one of a string of celebrities whose social media photos of their fabulous trips have led to thieves breaking into their empty palatial homes. We're on the briefing page now. The new monopolies. The inexorable growth of Google, Facebook, and Amazon has raised fears these giants are becoming too powerful. How dominant are these firms? As dominant as Standard Oil, Carnegie Steel, and American Tobacco were at the end of the 19th century, Google has an 88% market share in search advertising in the U.S., Facebook and its major subsidiaries, Instagram, WhatsApp, and Messenger, account for 77% of mobile social media traffic. And almost one of every $2 in online retail sales goes through Amazon. Flush with revenues of tens of billions of dollars, each company has heavily expanded into other industries. Google dominates video through YouTube, mapping, and personal email. Facebook is building consumer drones and virtual reality sets. Amazon recently bought the upscale grocery chain Whole Foods for $13.4 billion. Digital enthusiasts once predicted that the internet would democratize business and industry. Instead, it's enabled a handful of firms to have such a dominant market share that it's almost impossible to compete with them. T.J. Stiles, a biographer of the 19th century business magnate Cornelius Vanderbilt, says we are living in a second gilded age. Our lives, he said, are channeled once again through fewer and fewer companies controlled by a few men. What's wrong with monopolies? When companies control a market, they tend to use their power to eliminate competition, often to the detriment of consumers. They can force suppliers to lower their prices, cutting their profits, and can bankrupt their rivals by undercutting them, or simply buy them out. Massive companies can also use economies of scale to eliminate jobs, particularly in the digital era when much work can be automated. All this can result in reduced consumer choice, depressed wages, and a concentration of wealth in the hands of fewer people in fewer locations. Is that actually occurring? Yes, Amazon accounts for 52% of all U.S. book sales, 43% of all online commerce, and 45% of the fast-growing cloud computing market. The Seattle-based company has put most brick-and-mortar bookstores out of business, and last year had online sales 6 times higher than those of Walmart, Target, Best Buy, Nordstrom, Home Depot, Macy's, Kohl's, and Costco combined. The self-proclaimed Everything Store has absorbed many of its competitors, buying the largest online shoe retailer, Zappos, the most powerful live streaming video platform, Twitch, and the market leader in baby products, diapers.com. When the latter initially refused to sell, Amazon simply slashed its prices for its own baby products until diapers.com capitulated. What about the others? They're no less dominant. Facebook boasts 2 billion active users, more than a quarter of the human race. When CEO Mark Zuckerberg saw a social media threat from Instagram and WhatsApp, he spent $20 billion to buy them. A third social media competitor, Snapchat, rejected an offer of $3 billion, so Facebook launched a feature on Instagram, essentially replicating Snapchat's self-deleting videos and photos. Within a year, Instagram Stories has already attracted more daily users than its rival. Google's parent company, Alphabet, acquires an average of 1 company a week. More than 1 billion people worldwide use Gmail. For Google, Amazon, and Facebook's stockholders and executives, this staggering level of success has created enormous wealth. And the company's customers benefit from the unprecedented convenience their various services provide. But the domination of these tech giants also has produced plenty of losers, such as the newspaper industry is one example. Facebook and Google control more than 70% of the $73 billion digital advertising market in the U.S. Many of those dollars used to go to media companies. Between 2006 and 2016, U.S. newspaper advertising revenue plummeted from $50 billion to $18 billion. And the number of jobs in the industry has been cut by more than half, from 411,000 in 2001 to 174,000 in 2016. Journalism websites, too, are struggling to survive because Facebook and Google eat up most of the online ad dollars. Another example, department stores and malls. Hundreds of major retail stores have shut their doors because of the shift to online shopping, and dozens of malls have gone dark or are half empty. That, in turn, has damaged the vitality of downtowns and surrounding communities. The communities wither away, and they never come back, said Howard David Davidowitz, an investment banker and consultant to the retail industry. Is there any pushback? In the U.S., not much. The U.S. government generally has used a light hand in regulating tech companies so as not to stifle innovation and growth in what is now our fastest growing industry. Facebook, Google, and Amazon argue that they're not true monopolies because their much smaller competitors are only a click away, something that wasn't the case with, say, AT&T before it was broken up. And the big tech beasts spend vast sums keeping lawmakers on their side. Facebook alone poured $3.2 million into federal lobbying in the first quarter of this year. Ultimately, consumers would have to rebel en masse against these companies before U.S. lawmakers or regulators would take any action. And there's no sign that will happen. Google will do whatever it wants without asking permission, writes Jonathan Taplin in Move Fast and Break Things, and the results will be so awesome that nobody will complain. The other monopolies, The tech industry isn't the only one consolidating. More than 75% of U.S. industries have experienced an increase in concentration over the past two decades. 80% of plane seats are sold by just four airlines: American, Delta, Southwest, and United. The drugstore and pharmacy industry is dominated by the duopoly of CVS and Walgreens. The effects are obvious. Airlines are shrinking seats and services, charging for baggage and food, forcing passengers to make one or more stops, and raising the prices on non-competitive routes. With the number of big media companies also shrinking, Americans now fork out more than double what Europeans pay for high-speed broadband. Lina Khan of New America, a Washington-based think tank, says, "We are living in a world of extreme consolidation and concentration, and when there is less competition, consumers inevitably pay the price." Moving on to the best columns of the week, we'll take two from the U.S. this week. The first is titled, Democratic Hypocrisy on Russia. Democrats are exasperated that Republicans don't share their outrage over the ever-widening scandal surrounding Donald Trump in Russia, says James Kirchick. But on Russia, Democrats are total hypocrites. For 8 years, the liberals now calling Trump supporters Putin's pawns blindly supported Democratic President Obama's naive attempt to woo Vladimir Putin with concessions, the so-called reset. Obama removed missile systems in Poland and the Czech Republic and famously was caught on an open microphone telling a Putin ally that after the 2012 election, he'd have more flexibility to make concessions. During the 2012 campaign, Obama mocked Republican Mitt Romney's assertion that Russia was America's number one geopolitical foe. In 2012, Obama and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton objected to the passage of the Magnitsky Act, which imposed sanctions on Russian officials for human rights abuses. Obama essentially ceded Syria to Putin, and even after the Russian leader annexed Crimea in 2014, Obama dismissed Russia as a weak regional power. How weak does Russia seem now? Liberals, enraged by Trump's strange fondness for Putin, need to admit that their last president's policy on Russia was also an epic disaster. Why Trump may regret picking Pence. Of all President Trump's blunders, the biggest may have been choosing Mike Pence as his running mate, said Steve Chapman. Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation and Trump's erratic behavior make impeachment a real possibility, especially if congressional Republicans decide they'd rather have Pence in the White House. During Watergate, Richard Nixon had insurance policies in the form of two highly flawed vice presidents, Spiro Agnew, loathed by the majority Democrats, and, after Agnew resigned over a bribery charge, Gerald Ford, widely regarded as decent but dumb. For any president, the more unthinkable a vice president is for the top job, the better. But most Republicans find the pious Pence eminently thinkable. A canny political operator, he's beloved by Christian conservatives and has good relations with Congress. Democrats see Pence as a right-wing Puritan, but probably would prefer him to an unpredictable, thin-skinned narcissist who might nuke North Korea or Iran. As Russia revelations mount, both parties may gaze on Pence and say, "What are we waiting for?" On that day, Trump may wish he'd picked Chris Christie or Ted Cruz. And this is one of the How They See Us columns, international. America's Culture of Violence. Australia wants answers, said the Australian in an editorial. Australian citizen Justine Demond, 40, was doing the right thing when she was killed by a Minnesota police officer. The yoga teacher, engaged to be married to an American casino executive, heard what she thought were sexual noises outside her Minneapolis home and feared a woman was being raped. So she called 911. When the police arrived, Demond ran out in her pajamas to greet them and may have tapped the squad car, causing a noise. As she approached the driver's window, Officer Mohammed Noor opened fire from the passenger seat, past his partner, fatally striking Demond in the abdomen. The killing, as Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull has said, is inexplicable. Demond's grieving family here in Australia is anxiously seeking answers, but U.S. authorities are providing none. There's no video record because the two officers in the car both failed to activate their body cameras, and Noor, a jumpy rookie cop with a long list of disturbing allegations against him, won't talk to investigators, and his boss can't make him. That's simply not acceptable. We all know what killed Justine. America's insane gun culture, said David Penberthy in The Advisor. Second Amendment was intended to guarantee that citizens could form an armed militia to battle foreign invaders. But it now means that criminals, macho men, psychopaths, doomsday preppers, and terrorists can all get their hands on the deadliest weapons. No questions asked. No wonder police are so afraid that they shoot without warning. They operate in a heavily armed, unpredictable, trigger-happy society. If only America could shake its love of guns, said Aubrey Perry in the Sunday Age. Australia did that in 1996, after the Port Arthur massacre, when a gunman killed 35 people. Aussies said, never again, banned semi-automatic weapons, and patriotically handed in their firearms in a government buyback program. The social psychology shifted around guns, and that's what needs to happen in the United States. It's the police mindset that has to change, says Paul McGough in the Sydney Morning Herald. Australians may find it incredible, but the U.S. doesn't have a unified police training program. There are 18,000 state and local departments and 73 federal law enforcement agencies, each with its own culture and its own policies on recruitment, training, discipline, equipment, weapons, and operating procedures. Those police chiefs who try to reform their forces to focus on de-escalation rather than confrontation face intense pushback, both from police associations and from politicians. Under the Obama administration, the Justice Department created reform plans for dozens of dodgy police departments, but the Trump administration is scrapping those agreements. There's little hope that Demond's death will be the catalyst for change that America so desperately needs. And it is time for the last word feature, our in-depth article. The title this week, Washington's Secret Doomsday Plans. For six decades, U.S. officials have been developing top-secret plans to keep the government functioning in the event of a catastrophic nuclear attack, said historian Garrett Graff. Attorney General Ed Meese arrived at Andrew Air Force Base before dawn on June 18, 1986. One of dozens of officials and staff from the Pentagon, State Department, White House, and intelligence community streaming into the base in Maryland suburbs, ready for nuclear war. Those meeting Meese knew the Attorney General was stressed that morning, since Chief Justice Warren Burger had announced his resignation the day before. The official said Andrews looked at Meese and joked, "First a Supreme Court resignation, and now America's in a nuclear war. You're having a bad day." War, though, wasn't actually imminent. Officials were gathering instead for one of Ronald Reagan's most secret initiatives as president, the effort to ready the nation to rebuild after a nuclear war, part of a sprawling classified set of plans known as Continuity of Government, or COG, COG for short. During the Cold War, the government secretly invested billions of dollars in a complicated set of plans that would determine what activities and processes would be needed following a nuclear attack, and even what totems of American culture should be saved. Once assembled, the officials at Andrews Air Force Base were shuttled to a relocation facility, one of more than 100 bunkers and special sites built around the country through the Cold War, as well as other more mobile locations that the administration was hurriedly preparing to help maximize the chance of avoiding a Soviet decapitation strike. Armored command trains and convoys of lead-lined tractor trailers that could spread out across the country. The main evacuation facilities would be the two mountain bunkers that had served as the government's insurance policy since the beginning of the Cold War. Mount Weather in Berry Hill, Virginia, about 80 minutes west of Washington, and Raven Rock in Waynesboro, Pennsylvania, just over the Maryland border from Camp David. The two hollowed-out mountains, Mount Weather from the civilian government, Raven Rock for the military, had freestanding cities built inside them, capable of providing thousands of personnel with workspace and living facilities in three-story office buildings built inside the caverns. Protected by bunker doors the size of a small house, the facilities contained fire departments, police departments, medical facilities, cafeterias, command posts, and lake-sized reservoirs for drinking water. Everything you might need to lead a nuclear war while living underground for a month at a time. "It's kind of mind-boggling," said Buford Macklin, Housing and Urban Development's Reagan-era emergency planning coordinator, after visiting Mount Weather. "It's otherworldly, just the size and weight and massiveness of the doors. It's a mini-city, like a space station." Through the Russian-era exercises, the participants would work out of these and other facilities, held completely incommunicado, reachable only in an emergency by an unlabeled telephone number they left behind with their wives. Over the coming days, three different continuity of government teams would take turns leading the country, each working from a different secret relocation facility for 3 or 4 days before being nuked and then handing off responsibility to the next team. The relocation teams consisted of 40 to 60 staffers, a cabinet member like Meese, who would be the designated successor, and a senior team leader like Dick Cheney or Don Rumsfeld, who could step in as White House Chief of Staff. Much of the administration's planning fell to Marine officer on the National Security Council named Oliver North. Early in his White House tenure in 1982, North helped draft Reagan's National Security Decision Directive 55, titled Enduring National Leadership, and coordinated with FEMA's National Preparedness Directorate and two new agencies focused on COG planning, known by their innocuous cover names, the National Program Office and the Defense Mobilization Systems Planning Activity. Together, they represented a vast bureaucracy hidden in plain sight. For every dollar that FEMA spent preparing for natural disasters, the agency's public purpose, it spent $12 preparing for nuclear war and running continuity of government programs. Nearly a third of FEMA's entire workforce existed in the secret black budget, known only to 20 members of Congress. The National Program Office, run by Vice President George H.W. Bush, gobbled up billions of dollars in classified funds planning for doomsday. Building off an Eisenhower-era plan to appoint private sector czars to oversee post-disaster response, the National Program Office established a top-secret list of former public officials who would be called upon in the event key office holders were killed. Known as TREETOP, the plan outlined the military aides, war plans, and procedures that would make up the presidential successor support system, or PS3 for short. The five PS3 teams each consisted of veteran officials who could fill almost every top job in government. Respected former officials like Howard H. Baker Jr., the one-time Senate Republican leader, former CIA Director Richard Helms, former United Nations Ambassador Gene J. Kirkpatrick, and former Cabinet Secretary James R. Schlesinger were all readied to return to government following a decapitation attack. In an emergency, the PS3 teams of retired officials and government managers would each deploy to different bunkers, command posts, and secret facilities to be ready in case a presidential successor was needed then. Picked without regard to normal government operations or peacetime organizational charts, the PS3 teams were rooted in the assumption that following a massive attack, the presidential successor would likely be a minor and inexperienced cabinet official. Such a figurehead president would need to rely heavily and quickly upon more experienced staff to reconstitute a government, defend the nation, and begin to rebuild. Thus, when someone like the Commerce Secretary or Agricultural Secretary found themselves newly appointed president and arrived at an emergency site, they would find a White House staff in waiting, including an experienced leader like Rumsfeld or Cheney, who would serve as Chief of Staff designee. Theoretically, even as the nation lay in ruins following a nuclear attack, the government had carefully considered how the United States itself, how the idea of the United States would continue forward. It turned out to be a more existential question than planners originally imagined. What would it mean to preserve America? Is America its president? Is it three branches of government? Is it the Constitution? Officials gave deep thought to what activities and processes would be needed following a nuclear attack or widespread national emergency, and even what totems of America should be saved and which should be sacrificed. Throughout the secret Reagan-era exercises, participants tried to mimic the stress and conditions of an attack as best they could, living at the relocation facilities, eating MREs, and hotly debating the best responses to an unfolding attack. One of the awkward questions we faced was whether to reconstitute Congress after a nuclear attack, a participant recalled years later. It was decided that no, it would be easier to operate without them. As those Reagan administration personnel explored the nation's doomsday bunkers, they were amazed at the scope and sophistication of the government in hiding, a secret apparatus built up since the days of Harry Truman and Dwight Eisenhower. Inside the facilities, though, there was plenty of updating to do. Richard Clark, who worked in the State Department during the Reagan and Bush years, recalled arriving at the department's assigned building inside Mount Weather for an exercise, only to find on his desk a phone book labeled Secretary of State Christian A. Herter. He'd never heard the name before, so when he later returned to his office in Foggy Bottom, he looked it up and discovered that Herter had served more than two decades earlier under Eisenhower. The dusty pencils carefully positioned on Clark's assigned desk lay untouched, sharpened 20 years before. Pre-written presidential executive orders sat in office safes across Washington, as did secret draft legislation known as the Defense Resources Act, ready to be filled in Mad Lib style with dates and emergencies, laying out an entirely new structure for how the government would function during a national emergency, effectively suspending the Constitution and Bill of Rights. presidential football is well known. But less well known is how the Attorney General was accompanied through the darkest days of the Cold War by an emergency briefcase outlining FBI plans to sweep up thousands of Americans deemed a security threat. Long before Barack Obama made the Washington title Czar popular, Eisenhower had imagined an expansive set of secret powers, pre-selecting 9 men, mostly private citizens, who would be real czars, stepping in during an emergency to remake the private sector, seize assets coast to coast, and create new bureaucracies that would control nearly every aspect of American life until peace could be restored. The post office would be in charge of registering the nation's dead. The National Park Service would run the refugee camps. The Department of Agriculture would distribute rationed food. Congress would retreat to a special bunker at a West Virginia resort. The Supreme Court would relocate to another resort in the North Carolina mountains. The Department of the Interior would move to the grounds of a former college in Harpers Ferry, West Virginia. The Federal Reserve, kept in underground bunker, stocked with billions in cash inside Mount Pony, 70 miles south of Washington. FEMA would help the nation rebuild from regional bunkers in places like Denton, Texas, and Manor, Massachusetts. A state-of-the-art NORAD Air Defense Headquarters was carved under Colorado's Cheyenne Mountains with plans inspired by Raven Rock and Mount Weather. Government officials sat down and carefully considered before deciding that at the National Archives, in the event of a nuclear attack, the Declaration of Independence would be saved before the Constitution. At the National Gallery of Art, Leonardo da Vinci's Florentine masterpiece, Ginevra da Vinci, would be saved before Roger van der Weyden's Renaissance masterpiece, St. George and the Dragon. The Library of Congress knew it would save the Gettysburg Address before George Washington's military commission. In Philadelphia, a specially trained team of park rangers stood ready to evacuate the Liberty Bell into the mountains of Appalachia if the Soviets attacked. For nearly 50 years, the inner workings of the nation's continuity of government protocols were some of the government's best-kept secrets. Even colleagues in the same office didn't know the scope of the plans. When Aaron Sorkin was researching what would become The American President and the West Wing, Clinton aide George Stephanopoulos pulled out of his wallet what the Hollywood director first thought was a bus pass. It was actually the little card explaining how Stephanopoulos would be evacuated in the event of a nuclear attack. Sorkin incorporated that card into a later West Wing episode where character Josh Lyman received such a card from the National Security Council and felt guilty because his co-workers wouldn't be saved. While shooting the scene, set consultant Dee Dee Myers, the former Clinton press secretary, pulled Sorkin aside to tell him that the scene was unrealistic because those cards didn't actually exist. Sorkin was shocked. Even as a top aide, she'd never realized that her co-workers had exactly those cards, and she never did. Today, another generation of doomsday planners are settling into life inside these bunkers, which are still staffed 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. While some new facilities have been built in the past two decades, the majority of the government's plans to preserve itself and our nation during an attack in the 21st century still rely upon facilities built with slide rules. This was excerpted from Raven Rock, the story of the U.S. government's secret plan to save itself while the rest of us die. On the health and science page, we've got a short article that says, one creature that will outlast us. The hardiest animals on the planet aren't large, brawny, or cunning. This distinction goes to a simple-brained, water-dwelling micro-animals called tardigrades, or water bears. In new research, scientists have concluded that these nearly indestructible eight-legged creatures, which have been around for some 600 million years, will remain on Earth for another billion years, long after people and other animals are gone. There are more than 1,000 species of tardigrades. Each one has certain adaptations that enable it to tolerate otherwise lethal conditions, including extreme temperatures, intense radiation, and airlessness. A group of theoretical physicists contemplating various doomsday scenarios use these resilient animals as a barometer for the tenacity of life on Earth. The team considered three potential threats: a gamma ray burst, a giant asteroid impact, and a supernova, the massive explosion of a nearby star. They found that none of these events would obliterate all tardigrades, even if Earth's ozone layer and oxygen-rich atmosphere were destroyed. NationalGeographic.com reports, tardigrades, says study author Rafael Alves Batista of the University of Oxford, are as close to indestructible as it gets on Earth. We'll go right on to the talking points page. OJ, did he deserve parole? A parole board's decision last week to free O.J. Simpson from prison was correct and just, said David Zirn in TheNation.com. After serving 9 years of a 33-year sentence for stealing his own sports memorabilia from a Las Vegas hotel while someone with him pulled a gun, the fallen football hero, now 70, will walk free in October. Simpson's original sentence was absurdly excessive and was clearly a payback for his 1995 acquittal for the ghastly murders of estranged wife Nicole Brown Simpson and her friend Ron Goldman. The parole boards expressly said it could not factor in prior cases, said Sarah Gordon in the New York Post, and the law dictated that O.J. be granted parole. His age and his clean disciplinary record in prison indicate there's little chance Simpson will be a threat to society. Yes, Simpson earned parole like any other well-behaved 70-year-old convict, said Jeffrey Toobin in NewYorker.com. But like so many other people who followed his murder trial, I see the bloodied corpses of Nicole Simpson and Ron Goldman whenever I see his grin. Simpson belongs in prison, and he should remain there. In his statement to the parole board, O.J. sure didn't sound sorry for anything he's done, said Eric Deggans in NPR.org. He insisted that he had a right to take back his trophies and said, astonishingly, I basically spent a conflict-free life. This from a powerful athlete who repeatedly battered his wife and left her hospitalized in 1989 when he pled no contest to spousal battery. Later, Nicole and Goldman were so savagely murdered that their heads were nearly severed by a killer with a knife. It feels as if Simpson is the thorn America will never quite extract from its side. Proof of our tangled relationship with celebrity, wealth, media, criminal justice, and race. So what do you want to about Simpson? Say what you want to about Simpson, said John Diaz in San Francisco Chronicle. He really did change the country. His sensational arrest and trial began our country's 24/7 absorption of news and revealed the breadth of America's racial schism, with blacks largely believing he'd been framed by cops. More positively, the trial brought home the lethal danger of escalating abuse, contributing to the passage of the Violence Against Women Act, and showcased the science of DNA testing. No fleeting 1990s obsession, the Simpson trial jolted American culture in ways that reverberate today. and some shorter notes. This first one about Anthony Scaramucci, actually, though he's already out by the time you hear this. The White House's new communications director, Anthony Scaramucci, deleted his old tweets when he accepted the job last week, including posts advocating gun control, action on climate change, legal abortion, and ending the death penalty. Scaramucci said he was subordinating his politics to President Trump's agenda. Hawaii is rolling out an emergency plan to help residents and visitors prepare for a potential North Korean missile attack that could come with barely 8 minutes warning. The plan will include testing new emergency sirens on the first workday of each month and holding evacuation drills in schools. Donald Trump is the first U.S. president without a pet since Andrew Johnson, who left office in 1869. The CEOs of the 70 largest U.S. healthcare companies cumulatively have earned $9.8 billion in the 7 years since the Affordable Care Act was passed, and their compensation has grown 11% a year. Women and minorities are fueling a boom in the number of concealed handgun permits, from 4.6 million in 2007 to 16.3 million in 2016. Available state data shows the permits for men grew by 22% over 4 years, while they soared for women by 93%. The number of black people with permits increased 30% faster than the number of white people with permits. And there were several quotes today that I liked, so we'll take two of them to finish out the hour. The first comes from Ernest Hemingway. He says, "I drink to make other people more interesting." And I suppose as somewhat of a response, though not directly, the next quote is from Julia Child, who says, "Life itself is the proper binge." We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. I'm Fred Woodward, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.